The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
On today's Edinburgh Books podcast, we welcome Irish writers from the north and south with a pair of novels which examine the forces of history through its effect on family. After a career which included starring roles in Dancing at Lugnasa and Peter Greengrass's Omar, the actor Michelle Forbes turned to fiction with her first novel, Ghost Moth, a tale of submerged secrets set in Belfast as the Troubles ignite in 1969 and reaching back to 1949. But we'll begin in County Tipperary with Donal Ryan. It's a return to the territory of The Spinning Heart, a polyphonic portrait of village life which won him the Guardian First Book Award in 2013. His second novel, The Thing About December, pulls the focus in a little to just one character, Johnsy Cunliffe, who, over the course of a year, loses everything, winds up in hospital after getting beaten up, and tries to find a way of living with the ghosts of his past. Here we find Johnsy in March, with a year pure solid flying already, or at least the worst of the cold is gone.
Loneliness covers the earth like a blanket. It flows in the stream, down through the callows to the lake. It's in the muck in the yard, and the briars in the haggard, and the empty outbuildings are bursting with it. It runs down the walls inside the house like tears, and grows on the walls outside like a poisonous choking weed. It's in the sky and the stones and the clouds and the grass. The air is thick with it. You breathe it into your lungs, and you feel it might suffocate you. It runs into hollow places like rainwater. It settles on the grass and on trees, and takes their shapes, and all of the earth is wet with it. It has a smell, like the inside of a saucepan, scraped metal, cold and sharp. When it hits you, it feels like a rap of a hurley across your knuckles on a frosty winter's morning in PE. Sharp, shocking pain, but inside you, so it can't be seen, and no one says sorry for causing it, nor asks are you okay, and no kind teacher wants to look at it and tut and tell you you'll be grand, good lad. But you know, if another man stood where you're standing and looked at the same things, he wouldn't see it or feel it. He'd see that the fields are only wet with dew, and the walls only running because the vents are blocked with dirt and grime, and it's Virginia creeper climbing the house that people used to stop to admire for its lovely, fiery colours and their passage up the yard towards the front door. So it only exists in your head. It only occupies a tiny space. Is it even an inch squared? Probably not. How big is a feeling? Not even as big as one of them atoms that science teacher used to be on about. It's nothing and everything at the same time. The world doesn't change, nor anything in it, when someone dies. The mountains keep their still strength, the sun its heat, the rain its wetness. Blackbirds still hop and flutter about the back lawn, fighting over worms. The cat still screeches and paws at the back window for her grub. Bees still dance about the flowers and the apple trees, always searching, searching. There's an awful cruelty in the business of nature, in the brutal sameness of things. The sky was the same blue the day after Daddy died as it was the day before. The uncaring rain didn't stop while they buried Mother, only bucketed ignorantly down and ran in muddy rivers from the height to the road below.
So, when we spoke after you won the Guardian First Book Award with Spinning Heart, you said the novel began with the voices shouting to get onto the page. Was that how it was with Johnsy Cunliffe?
It kind of was, because originally Johnsy was a very peripheral character in a novel I wrote in my 20s that was kind of okay, and it was kind of funny, and it was all right. And I remember I'm rereading it and saying, yeah, it's good. And that's kind of the worst thing you want to hear from your trusted beta reader, that, yeah, it's good, you know, because you know it's not great. So I sat down to rewrite that novel, and I happened to start with a chapter concerning Johnsy Cunliffe. And all of a sudden he became very real and very clear, and I could see his face and I could hear him speaking, and realised, yeah, this book is going to be about Johnsy. And, you know, he came very much alive for me.
I've got a kind of bookkeeping question first for anyone who's not started either of the two books yet. Just because while The Spinning Heart was published first, your first published novel, you actually started with The Thing About December, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It was the first time that I'd finished writing something that I felt kind of happy with. And it was a new feeling, because for 20 years I'd been trying, I'd be starting novels, and I finished a novel, and it just all seemed like rubbish, you know, it just wasn't good enough. And after finishing that manuscript, I thought, this is actually okay, I'm quite happy with this. I think because I was so fond of Janzi, that was a lot of it. And it flowed much more easily than any writing I'd ever done.
But the two novels are kind of part of the same universe in some sense. You kind of went bang straight onto the next, did you?
I did, yeah. The day after I finished Think About December, the first draft, I started The Spinning Heart. Really just to kind of to keep in there, to stay writing. And I suppose the decision to publish them inversely, it turned out to be a great idea, really.
Weirdly, I came to them the other way around, of course, reading The Spinning Heart first. But for me, that was a bit of a trouble, reading the first book, because there's a kind of shadow over one of the characters, and I was kind of always expecting the axe to fall. I mean, is that something you'd kind of worry about with a reader?
Yeah, I do. I kind of worry that we give the game away a little bit in The Spinning Heart. But luckily, most people don't seem to notice, because I think it's early on in the first chapter, so although I suppose I shouldn't say that now, because it's out there now, yeah. Yeah, but I do counsel people to read The Thing About December first if they haven't read either book. Yeah.
It's set almost 10 years early, in about 2001, as the Celtic Tiger is kind of leaping forwards, and Johnsy finds himself sitting on top of a fortune out of nowhere. It was part of the impetus for the book, part of the reason why you kind of really wanted to do it, to explore how the kind of big shots turned this piece of land into something else.
Yeah, you know, that kind of, it was kind of in the back of my head, lurking a little bit, but it wasn't an express intention when I started the book, because Janzi was really my sole focus. The forces acting on Janzi and how he reacted to these, and his kind of internal discourse that kind of goes through the book. But it was definitely there, you know, how someone can be so easily bullied, and just by being passive, by not moving, you can be such powerful forces can be exerted on you in such kind of a harmful way. But Janzi really was my sole focus, yeah. The malign forces, they're kind of one-dimensional in the book, really. You know, I don't want to explore them too much.
I mean, it's amazing how far he gets carried in the 12 months of the story, where he comes from and where he winds up. I mean, that journey was what you're interested in on a kind of personal level.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, at a wider level, I mean, it happened in Ireland, because by that time, by 01, our real boom had finished. You know, that was predicated on education and a skilled workforce and, you know, and a buoyant market. And the madness had started, you know, the bubble had started. It started to inflate wildly. And so there were loads of people whose lives were dramatically changed because the land that they owned was rezoned and it got this notional value that was just crazy. But, you know, it did happen. I'm sure not in the same way it had happened to Janzi, but it happened. So it's not wild fantasy.
He talks later in the book about, I mean, some of his closest friends are part of the deal that's being put together, and he goes picking plums, isn't it, in the garden, and everything he says is lovely and comfortable and normal and destroyed forever at the same time. Yeah. Is that kind of how it felt during the boom in rural Ireland?
It did, kind of, because we kind of had a new face, really, you know, and it didn't sit well on us, you know. We didn't wear this new wealth very well, because wealth was almost democratized during the boom, you know. Just anyone that wanted to be wealthy could be wealthy if you're willing to take a few risks, and there was a point where there didn't seem to be any risk. You know, any property that you bought was going to definitely increase in value during your ownership of it, you know. And we really became convinced this is never going to change. But for a large part of the population of Ireland, wealth didn't sit well, it didn't sit comfortably. It was actually an ugly mask that we wore.
There's a similar suspicion of words in both novels, isn't it? Johnsy, he's almost unable to talk sometimes. He's worried that words could make an awful fool of you, and wondering if war, if running and firing a gun and trying to avoid being blown to bits were easier things than talking. It's a kind of funny thing for a novel to be so suspicious of words.
Yeah, Johnsy is kind of in this world that he doesn't understand at all. You know, before that it was okay, because he was in this little microcosm and it was fine, it was comfortable, it was lovely. But now he's cast adrift. These things have all changed, and Janzi can't change, because he's so determined that the land, he has to fix the earth firm. He can't leave the land or do anything with it. And there is, because Janzi is kind of searching for truth all through the novel, and it eludes him all the time. And at one point, he's so confused, he has no idea who's thinking what, and all of his firmly held convictions are shattered. And yeah, it's kind of tragic, all right, with the Unthanks, and because their characters I'm really fond of as well. And it's a little, I kind of left it a little bit ambiguous, you know. It's a bit open. You're not really sure, you know, were they affected by the greed, or did you just go along with it?
But the rezoning, that mask, as you put it, it turns up straight away in their talk, where as soon as the decision's announced, they're talking over each other, and the speed they're talking at, it wasn't right somehow.
Yeah, I kind of intended that to seem unnatural for the young things, because they're so gentle and laconic, you know, and they're just this kind of warm force in Johnsy's life, this kind of cushion of warmth, and because that whole concept was so unnatural, it causes this unnatural reaction in the young things. And it kind of frightens him, I think.
Yet disaster comes from not talking as well. Paddy O'Rourke bottles it up until, like a mountain out of foreign, he blows his top and explodes. Is this novel, again, another machine for trying to say the unsayable?
Yeah, because that's a problem. You know, it's a problem for men, I think, a lot of the time. But we do, you know, tend to have these feelings that kind of well up inside. And you hear these stories, you know, especially in rural areas, you know, killing tragically. You know, this lack of communication and embarrassment about feeling.
It's a kind of fruitful aim for a novel, though, isn't it? To kind of try and explore this gap between the truth and what you're able to say. You do it often through a language which feels like people talking. I mean, was this part of the aim as well, to capture the way somebody speaks?
Yeah, the novel is written in the third person because Johnsy is so silent. But the novel describes Johnsy's internal discourse with himself. But I couldn't do it in the first person because Johnsy wouldn't speak. So it'd be too much of a reach for Johnsy, because I want him to be silent. It's a very spurious statistic, but I think in rural Ireland, about one man in 15 is almost completely silent. But that's based on the fact that when I was in school, there were nearly always classes of 30, and there were always two guys from the country who just didn't talk. So it just stayed with me, yeah, about one in 15 of these guys just don't talk.
It's written in sections of about a page or so, usually. Is each one of those basically a session at the computer?
I think so, actually, thinking back, because I wrote it in almost perfect 3-hour sessions over a year, every night. And I realised, because my grip on confidence was so tenuous, that if I stop at any point here, I could stay stopped, you know. So I really had to make myself, for that whole year, do 3 hours between 9 p.m. and midnight every night. And it worked, thank God.
It's kind of like an athletic routine you got into. You just sat down, okay, 3 hours, and that's it, you're finished. Okay.
Yeah, now that I'm a full-time writer, I can allow myself not to force myself, you know. So, but at that time, I had to, you know, my time was so limited that I had to do it, and to build it up. It was actually like, you know, training muscles in the gym, yeah.
So we can expect in the next novel, in the third, we can expect longer sections, more kind of lyrical kind of openings, can't we?
Yeah, I do tend to have very long run-on sentences, actually, my short stories, almost longer even in the thing about December, so, yeah.
There are moments in the book where you kind of reach beyond that kind of ordinary speech and into something slightly more poetic, what Sebastian Barry called your sixth gear. Do you sort of feel the gear shift manually, or is it kind of something that happens more organically?
Yeah, I have to thank Sebastian for that, actually. For the whole review, actually, which is beautiful. But yeah, because there's a thing, actually, with the spinning heart and the thing about December that's a little bit unrealistic, because it's kind of a heightened speech. People probably wouldn't speak this way, even though it's in the demotic. So at first glance, it looks as though, yeah, this is just ordinary demotic speech. But there's a kind of heightening, because people wouldn't say the things they're saying in the normal run of things. So I kind of had it in my head that the characters kind of were behind a gauze, and the person they were speaking to was occluded from them, almost like a confessional. And so they just do tend to just let it out and let it rip.
When we spoke last year, you said you were working on a novel with a very happy ending. Yeah. How's that working out? Is it still looking a little less bleak?
Sure is. I actually have the ending written, and it's not going to change. I'm determined about that. So I'm writing this novel towards the ending. It's great, actually. It's given me a great sense of freedom, actually, for the novel itself, yeah. So that's out in, actually, I think, 2016, because the short stories should be out next March.
I'm wondering if literary fiction, I mean, looking around at the books that come into The Guardian, whether literary fiction has a trouble with happy endings, whether it's kind of an embarrassment sometimes, even.
It does seem like that, all right, actually. And people have told me that they're a little bit cross with me for my endings. But I do, and you know, I'm a reader who loves happy endings myself, you know, so I'm almost betraying my own affection for happy endings. But, you know, I think an ending has to feel natural. That's really the main thing for me. I think when it comes to Johnsy, it's kind of a little bit obvious from almost page one, you know, where it's heading in some form. Maybe the actual form of the ending isn't obvious, but the reader kind of is fairly much on alert, I think, from the start.
Watching out for him. I mean, do you agonise about the fate of your characters? Do you like putting them through the mill, or is it difficult for you?
No, I got really upset over Johnsy, because I got really, really emotionally involved. And I'm quite emotional anyway, you know, I cry fairly easily, you know, so I got very upset. I kind of went a bit mad. Luckily I had Marie to kind of pull me out of this madness for that year as I was writing that book. But yeah, I did. You know, and I've heard writers say that you can't, you must be dispassionate. You have to cast a cold eye on your narrative. You have to be removed from it, be completely outside it. But I maybe that's correct, but for me, it wouldn't work.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Michelle Forbes is another author who's prepared to put her characters through the mill. But for the author of Ghost Moth, literature offers a valuable space for reflection in our shiny modern world.
I definitely think there's a perception about literary fiction for that very reason, that we feel it has to be very sombre, very serious. But there still is a joy in that. I mean, a happy ending, what exactly does that mean? You know, a satisfactory ending is a happy ending, whether it's you have a laugh at it or not. So I think whatever ending the narrative demands, really, is a happy one.
It's just that thing of the sort of population statistics of it. As you see the books coming in the sackfuls, they're basically pretty bleak, mostly.
Yeah, well, people love a bit of misery as well, you know. They do. And I actually think it's no harm, because everything is so fast these days, so quick, and everything has to have a kind of a witty response and the whole thing, that to slow down and just kind of breathe in the darkness a bit, I don't think it's too bad at all. And there's such a variety of other stuff that you can turn to then to read in literary fiction to lift the spirits. So, no, I wouldn't stop it or rule it out or ban it or censor it at all. Writing Ghost Moth, I actually had the ending very early on. Somebody described, I think it was Declan Hughes, described as, you know, you see your ending and you get into the lake and you head for it across the other side of the lake in your boat. But for me, what happened was I got into the boat and I went right in circles so many times before I got there. But I knew where I wanted to pitch it, and it was the flavour and the sense of it, the closure of the book. I knew that's where it was going to go. So it kind of informs what comes before that, and that's you know, it will dictate where you bring the book, I think.
So you say you started with the ending in view, but was that the kind of the impulse? Was it the story, or was there something else you were kind of going for when you began?
No, the impulse, I think, was to reconnect, certainly with Belfast and with my childhood in Belfast. That was a big impulse, to get words down in the page. Also the whole sense, because my background is in theatre, and my parents on an amateur level were involved in theatre and musical theatre and run writing as well. I wanted to delve into that world, but I was so interested in going back in time. So these ideas were floating around in my head, and also the whole sense of memory has always interested me, in how we hold on to things in the past. And in Ghost Moth, of course, the two layers there are the personal and intimate holding on of hurt and pain, and also the wider canvas of the political holding on of hurt and pain. So I really was very interested in exploring that. So they were the main impulses, to get words down on the page first. And it was a learning curve for me, because it was the first time I'd written a novel. But I got there in the end.
August 1969. The seal appears from nowhere, an instant immutable presence in the sea, although he must have been swimming silently beneath the surface for some time without her knowing. Catherine shudders in the water. Her thoughts are moving like fast, cold spikes inside her head. Where has he come from? Is he lost? Has he come to feed? The seal's heavy muzzle thrusts toward Catherine. His nostrils, two dark inlets, flare. He is taking in her smell, her fear. His stiff eyebrow hairs, beaded with sea drops, crisscross the thick shadowy skin of his dark, wide head. Battle-scarred, his snout slopes to an ugly, dull point, where his long, wiry whiskers afford him the seductive familiarity of a family dog. But it's his eyes the eyes of this wild animal that terrify Catherine the most. Huge, opaque, and overbold, they hold on her like the lustrous black-egged eyes of a ruined man. Briefly, the seal's lips roll to display his sharp conical teeth. Strong enough to dismember a large bird, she thinks. Strong enough to rip her flesh. Her panic rises. If she turns her head away from him to look for help, even for a second, God knows what he'll do. He may strike. Seals startle easily, someone once told her. Their behaviour as unpredictable as human love. Yet if she remains where she is... They tread the cold sea together, Catherine and the seal. Above them, sandpipers drop their miserable cries as they fly. Splinters of high voices peak in the blue wind. In the distance, there is the low mechanical chirr of a train. Around them, the sea continues its cool, lamenting slap. A sudden thought. Is he alone? Are there more seals? Are there cows or pups to aggressively protect? The bobbing sea confuses the distance between them. It feels as though he is moving closer to her with every swell. She is keenly aware of her quivering limbs, of her too quick breathing, of the salt water in her mouth, a jagged, dark fear filling her up. Her mind shrinks to the size of one thought. He may kill me. Out of this fear, there is the sudden impulse to reach out and touch him. Like the only way to stop the white panic of vertigo is to jump, to finish it, to decide to finish it. Or by reaching out, by touching, she might just connect with him, soothe herself, make it mean something. Madness, she knows, but his heavy beauty is suggesting just this. She doesn't do it.
Did you start in 1969 in the garden at the back of that house in Belfast, or was it the material from earlier in Catherine's life, from 1949, that began?
Definitely 69 was the first time period I started in, and that's because I was drawing on what I remembered, what I knew as a child. I mean, Elsa in the book, she's 9-year-old, and that's where I place myself in a way, and seeing the world through Elsa's eyes. Why I did that was because this was the summer of 1969, before what we now know as the Troubles started, and so there was that impending doom, but not quite knowing what was going to happen. And as a child, I think you're taking that in, you're receiving that, and so in a way this was me processing it much later. So it started in the back garden, and I kind of waited to see who would turn up, thinking Elsa would carry the book from beginning to end. But her mother became much more interesting to me, and I began to think about her and what her background was, and the story developed from that, and just sticking with Catherine.
Because there's this important moment in her life when she's in the amateur production of Carmen back in 1949, and this kind of, you felt the pull from the 60s to go back and explore this moment, is it?
Maybe not so much a pull. Going forward in time from 60, that would have meant me entering into, undoubtedly, a kind of bigger political arena. And I really wanted to concentrate on the ordinary life, and I wanted to concentrate on the family and on the love between the family, and on, Catherine's past, her discovery of love. And again, the kind of ordinary stories that were happening at the time. Cimicini talks about the smell of ordinariness, and that kind of phrase was going right in my mind as well, and I'm seeing if I could champion that in a way in the writing. But going back as well, the sense of nostalgia, the sense of the stories my father would have told me of Belfast at that time. It was a completely different city to what I grew up in. You know, in the 70s it was a city under siege, but going back then, cafes were open, restaurants, the cinemas, queues for cinemas in the main square, and I just thought, that's amazing. As a teenager, I thought, that's not the city I know, and I really wanted to kind of delve into that a bit and just get a flavour of it.
For a novel of secrets like this, the historical setting has got obvious advantages, just in the way that, I mean, these days in the 21st century we share so much, we post things online and so on, but back in the 60s, and even more so in the late 40s, that life is very much more constricted.
I think the sense of decorum in both time frames was interesting to play with and to honour, if you like, because you have to kind of work within that. And certainly Catherine's liaison with Tom McKinley, the tailor, is in modern day standards quite measured, but it is so passionate. The sense of Catherine's choice, the sense of her, because at the time, and this is not giving too much away, but she's engaged to George Bedford at the time she meets Tom McKinley, who measured her for her costume for Carmen. And so there is a conflict there. So there is, you know, kind of nodding the head to, as I say, that decorum. She's betrothed, if you like, to George, but there's this amazing wild passion which surfaces in her when she meets Tom. So it's the battle, the conflict between those two things.
There's a certain joy to be had in reading your novel, that there's moments when you just nail an image exactly right. I mean, there's the seal whose dark eyes hold Catherine's like the lustrous black-egged eyes of a ruined man. Or later on in the book, there's a congregation which passes coughs along the pews as if passing a collection basket. When you get to those moments as a writer, do you sort of feel, oh, done it, nailed it?
Well, that's a little bit kind of patting yourself on the back, which is I'm superstitious about doing that. No, but you do feel something settle. That's really all I can say. It's something settles and you go, I'm going to leave that alone and not tamper with that too much. And it's kind of, I think it's knowing when to interfere, when to change and when not to. That is the thing. But there is a satisfaction when you're, and you are working hard to get something to jump off the page and to mean something in that way, to capture a detail in the way that you feel it. It might necessarily be the way someone else feels it, but I'm finding the response to Ghost Moth, it's been really warm, and a lot of people have said to me, oh my God, that's you know, you have nailed that image, whatever. And that's very rewarding to hear that, you know, because you do try hard to get it right.
One thing you've certainly got right are the kids. I mean, the way that that Stephen recognises his sister and is simultaneously delighted and relieved, or the way that that Elsa is both frightened of the kid pursuing her with the underpants and also feels a bit stupid for being frightened. There's also that moment when Catherine, after a long day looking after them, just wants to kind of shut the door on motherhood just for a bit. I mean, you're drawing from life there, aren't you?
Yes. Many years of experience before I wrote the book, research. I mean, to see the world through the eyes of your children is quite a special thing and a privilege. So, of course, all those details which I have two children, they're much older now. One's in her early 20s and my son is 15. But I did record a lot of stuff when they were young. I would write it down because you just think this is incredible. The way they can sum up an image or talk about something or see something, and the use of language. So yes, I would have kept a little notebook of bits and pieces. I mean, I was slightly envious of Anne Enright, who wrote Making Babies. I kind of wanted to see if in a way I could bring in what I remembered and what I'd written down into a narrative. But it's a very special thing to me to kind of focus in on that ordinariness of life. And
there are still nuggets there for the next novel. You're going to be mining those notebooks for years to come.
How many notebooks do I have? and now I have grand nieces and grand nephews. I know you're looking at me. I know you're looking at me saying, "Never, no, you're far too young." It's kind of important to write things down as they happen, as they occur to you, because you think I'm going to remember that, and you actually don't. So I am guilty of having notebooks everywhere in the house, just, you know, to get those thoughts down. Yeah.
Your chapters often dive straight into the middle of something and then wind back a little bit to fill in the background and then carry on from there. Is that a kind of technique that you're using, or is that just how it comes?
Oh, technique. No, I'm you know, finding my way in the dark most of the time. Anne Tyler described her process as it was just a bit like knitting. And I kind of felt a little bit the same, you know, and you drop stitches and then you'd be too many on the knitting needle. But, you know, you eventually end up with something which resembles a jumper, that kind of thing. So, no, I had no overall plan for this. And it came together by a kind of sense of a kind of osmosis, really. And it was very fluid. I would move where the impulse took me. And then at the end I had to shape it. I knew I had to give a satisfactory shape to the story, but it came together in many different parts. Writing the second book now, I'm much more structured, and I'm hoping that doesn't kind of take away the kind of spontaneity, but I was very keen to kind of place things, the structure of it, quite early on, so we'll see how that goes.
The novel leaves the reader measuring a kind of quiet, enduring love against another which burns brightly and is gone, like a lighted twist of paper in the night. Was that a calculation you were trying to kind of make in your head as you were writing?
Again, the sense of what we hold on to, what ignites us, and what's good for us was what interested me in that. And for Catherine, as I say, it is a conflict, that love she's feeling, and what does she do with that? And also the many other themes in the book, I was interested in the sense of how we hold on, in terms of the title as well, The Ghost Moth, how we hold on to the dead as well, and how useful or how damaging is that to us? How does it hold us back, or how does it enrich us? So those ideas were moving in my head as I was writing. So I was conscious of that, definitely, and of weaving that into the story of Ghost Moth, yeah.
Did you, you say you had the ending pretty much in view right from the start, but did you feel for your characters as you were kind of putting them through their various kind of troubles?
In a way, I would ask questions of the characters in the same way as I would have approached a character as an actress. And so there is an identification. You can't really escape that. And yes, you do care. It sounds a bit soppy, but you do really care for them. Your intention is that the reader feels it. And again, in terms of performance, often if when you're playing something and you kind of go to the depths, there's a kind of tiny percentage where that consciousness is there saying, this is really for the audience to feel, not me. If you lose yourself 100%, I think sometimes you can miss out on that. So
with lose the audience
because they're going, well, it's all, you know, I've nothing left for me to feel. So I think you need to leave that where you kind of go down into the character. You still need to be conscious that this, you're telling a story, and the reader has to own that story, and you have to hand it over. But I suppose that's kind of muscle was there within me to before I started the writing, you know.
And you say you're in the middle of a second now. Is this going to be a novel with a happy ending?
I'm not sure, because I don't have the ending. So I am. It's a little bit more chronological. I mean, I'm interested again in the theatre in the second novel, because my grandfather was theatre manager of two theatres in Belfast in the 1920s. So I have a little a dedication book to him from all the music hall acts which passed through, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I began to think, what lives did these people live? And it was a very hard life for them on the circus the whole time. So that's my broad frame. But again, I'm going into the family relationship between a husband and wife and how they deal with all this. I think they end up on the run. That's where I'm kind of... So I have to figure that one out.
Michelle Forbes' Ghost Moth is published by Phoenix, while Black Swan publishes Donald Ryan in Ireland. You can find more Literary Talk on iTunes, or follow us on SoundCloud, or join in the discussion on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer Ian Chambers, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.